Welcome to another edition of Lex Talk History, a podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Now, here's your hosts, Lexington History Museum Executive Director Mandy Higgins and WUKY's own Alan Lytle.
Hello again, Mandy.
Hello, Alan.
Boy, have I got that July vibe going.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a lot of movement at the museum, and we'd like to give people an idea of what's been going on at the museum.
So much has happened at the museum in the last month. And, you know, as we sit here sort of enjoying our July and hopefully slower days of the summer, I really need it. So I'm glad to be here. We are so proud to have debuted our 250 Lex exhibit called Intersections, 250 Years of Lexington History. It opened on Juneteenth and will be up through July of next year. So folks have time to come see it. But this exhibit has been really a labor of love over the course of the last many months to get open and is our attempt to... Our very good attempt, I should say, to tell Lexington's history over those 250 years in a way that's approachable. So intersections. So how do people connect in Lexington? How did this city come about and who made it possible?
Boy, it's an awfully tall order to do 250 years of history.
Yes, it is.
Talk about that.
So we originally... Many months ago, probably over a year ago, started thinking about this with the 250 Lex Commission, and they wanted an overarching history, and we were like, okay, well, I guess that's our charge, and so
done.
We can do it. We'll do it. So we batted around a lot of ideas and kept coming back to these stories of people and how individual Lexingtonians who maybe we know and maybe we don't know made these really incredible contributions to the city that are sometimes just not, they're part of our daily life and we don't really think about it. So we landed on doing a kind of a dual piece. The exhibit is grounded or centered by a timeline that starts at 1775, acknowledging that there were people here before the McConnell brothers, but starts at 1775 and takes you through till today, major milestones in the development of the city. And then around the room, outside of the timeline, are clusters of folks who worked in specific industries or who have a specific talent. So, for example, artists that have called Lexington home. Known artists like Henry Faulkner we talk about, and lesser known artists like Isaac Scott Hathaway, who's the first African-American to mint a U.S. coin, grew up in Lexington, was educated in Lexington, and so we have a couple of his coins on display. We also have brought in some contemporary folks who you may see their artwork, but you don't know anything about them. So Wiley Cottle, who's a really prolific muralist in Central Kentucky. We have a dress that he painted on display and tell a little bit of his story. Kiptu Torres, who's a wood predominantly does wood carvings and is an immigrant from Kenya. We have a maquette of his on display. So weaving in all of those pieces that make Lexington what it is and the sort of people who did it. You can also learn about medicine, equine, sports. We heard over and over again in the couple of years that we've been open, why don't you have a UK basketball exhibit? Well,
UK used to have a basketball museum.
UK had a basketball museum. You can, like, go on YouTube and see anything you ever wanted to see about the University of Kentucky basketball team, Mittens basketball team. But if we're thinking about how the city developed, you really can't not talk about UK basketball. Two major buildings exist because of the basketball team. Jim Host, in the work that he did in sports marketing from right here in town, all of that led to, and then the fans, right? Like, Lexington is so deeply connected.
Big Blue Nation.
Big Blue Nation really does, as a proud member of Big Blue Nation. the impact of the fans on the city really matters. And we see that when we're not having good seasons and bars and restaurants struggle. And we see that when we're having incredible seasons and tourism and getting tickets and the economic impact really does come into the city. And so we talk a little bit about that, but also about folks like Gay Brewer, who won the Masters in 1967. The development of Rupp Arena and urban renewal and the way that's influence on the built environment of the city, all of that. So get your reading eyes ready.
Be prepared to read the panels.
Yes, read the panels. You'll learn a whole lot. And I'm sorry, I keep talking about this. I'm so excited. Really, maybe my favorite interactive ever. We put into this one. We were working with the Central Bank Center on understanding the development of Rupp Arena through urban renewal and all of that. And they handed me this box of slides, truly like Kodak slides.
Oh, a
right?
discovery moment.
Right.
Coming on.
So I feel like, oh my God, could we do something with the display of the slides? Like, could we have a carousel? Because shout out Mad Men fans. What could we do? And finally, I was like, oh, we could have ViewMasters. Do you remember
yes,
ViewMasters?
Absolutely. My father, you know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So they still, you can make custom view. They're not called ViewMasters. Obviously, that was trademarked. But you can make custom view things that look exactly like your childhood ViewMaster. And we put 7 of those slides on a ViewMaster. And you can click through and see the construction of Rupp Arena. We also have one for Elmendorf Farms. I'm obsessed with this idea. I love it so much. And it's such a low tech, but high impact interactive because you get your nostalgia feels, but you're also learning something out of it. And of course, we have sanitary wipes at every station, so you don't have to worry about who looked at it before you. And we have a lot of audio included in the exhibit through thanks to the University of Kentucky's Nunn Center, to the UK Sports Network, to WLEX, and to Lex TV, as well as some music. So there's a lot to take in. And then I'll take a breath and stop being so excited about this. We're not done. So what you see today will look different over the next couple of months as we continue to add to it. There are some clusters that we want to develop further that we know we need to add, including a good segue into our topic this month, culinary. Mm-hmm. Lexington is definitely a foodie town and has been for a long time. And we have a deep history of that will come into the museum soon, as well as actors and politicians and some other groups.
All right. So if we were to sum it up, and you gave your, let's say, your elevator speech about this particular exhibit, mm-hmm. I'll give you the floor for that amount of time.
Intersections, 250 years of Lexington history, interweaves lesser known and sometimes untold stories of Lexington's history through the people who made it. You can visit Thursdays and Fridays, 12 to 4, Saturdays, 10 to 4, group tours, school groups, by appointment Monday through Friday. If you're desperate and you want to, like, really sugar me up, maybe I'll, you know, like,
personally call. Guided tour.
A personally guided tour might be possible, but I'm a busy girl.
I was going to say, talk about a perk there.
You know. So you can't, but it will be up through July 6th, 2026. So not only does this exhibit talk about the 250th anniversary of Lexington, but also the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and America 250. Because Lexington, as the first major city in the first American West, has shaped the United States as well. And so many of the people in our exhibit aren't just folks who made Lexington, but they changed the way that the United States interacts. Really quickly, can I give one plug because it's so hot?
Absolutely.
I've been talking about her for a week because I'm obsessed. University, also University of Kentucky grad, but engineering for Margaret Ingalls. Margaret Ingalls is the first woman to graduate from the University of Kentucky College of Engineering in 1916, and she created the device that can register and track relative humidity, which made home air conditioning possible.
Wow.
and it is hot. So every day that you're in your house and your air conditioning kicks on, just remember that it was a University of Kentucky College of Engineering grad that made that possible for you.
See, there's your little nugget right there that you didn't know that you needed to know.
Yes. Also, the picture of her is so cool. She's like in a steel factory, like in a foundry on the campus. Ugh, it's incredible. So come learn about Margaret and some other inventors and so many people.
All right. So now it is time to pivot toward Let's Get Into It and our special guest today.
We're so excited to have Deirdre Skeggs from the University of Kentucky Special Collections and Research Center. Truly the organization that makes all of Lexington History Museum's research possible. So thanks for joining us, Deirdre.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
So this month for 250 Lex, it's culinary month, as we kind of teased earlier. It's foodie month. Lexington obviously has this deep culinary history. We've got confectioners here by 1805. We've got James Beard finalists in the 21st century. We're just in an incredible, very lucky to have a lot of food here. But we also have maybe some seedy culinary history that you can help us understand.
I think we're definitely going to go into the dark side of culinary history today.
Yes, we love the dark side. Before we find out about this poison salmon, can you tell us a little bit about the work at the research center and some of like how any of this came about before you get to your story?
Yeah, sure. So the Special Collections Research Center is the repository for Kentucky's history. We, of course, being part of the University of Kentucky, we are part of that land grant mission. So we collect in all areas of Kentucky history, agriculture, to political history and university history as well. So the Special Collections Research Center has the university archives, and we have materials dating back to President Patterson, the first president of the university, to, as you mentioned, the basketball team and contemporary, more contemporary records documenting that history. And so part of the history of the university is Maxwell Place. And so that's where our story is going to take place today. Maxwell Place is a historic property built in 1872 for Judge James Hillary Mulligan as a wedding gift from his father. And it was named for Maxwell Springs, which was located near the property. And it was sold to the university in 1917. And President McVeigh was the first UK president to live there, and President Capiluto resides there now.
And many, if you're a student, if you've been a student at UK, you've walked past Maxwell Place probably and cutting across campus. I like to park there occasionally if I need something from you all. So it is still kind of that center of that part of campus. It's a pretty...
It is, and, you know, they've made it so welcoming. There's a lovely pond and there's benches and people like to eat lunch there and be in the shade.
Yes.
Especially right now. So yeah, it's definitely a landmark.
Yes.
On
when
campus.
I was a student, Patsy Todd would occasionally have cookies for folks walking through. It was those were the days.
I have heard great tales about her and her cookies. Yes. And hospitality.
But before it was sold to the university, it was a private home.
Yes, yes. And so Judge Mulligan lived there with his first wife, Mary Houston Jackson. They got married in 1869, and they had four children. She unfortunately died in 1876, and Judge Mulligan remarried Genevieve Morgan Williams in 1881. They also had four children. So just to, you know, set the tone, we have Judge Mulligan, eight children, two different women.
That's a lot.
Yes. And he was a prominent member of Lexington, obviously, he became a judge, but he was a newspaper editor, he was an attorney, he was a legislator, he was consul general to Samoa, he was really good friends with Robert Louis Stevenson.
How?
They met in Samoa.
Okay.
And became really close friends.
Interesting.
Yes.
So, I have so many not related podcast questions.
I know. Yeah. So that's probably a whole other story. But also, he was a poet. And his poem, I mean, if anyone has ever seen a historic postcard of Kentucky with a poem on it, it's probably his poem. It's called In Kentucky. Definitely one of the best known poems of the state. He delivered this at the close of a speech at the Phoenix Hotel in 1902. Yes, so well respected.
Yes.
All sorts of circles. At least until 1904, when, as you mentioned, there was a plot to poison the Mulligan family.
Dun dun dun.
Yeah, I have...
Sorry.
Oh, no, you're right. I mean, so this guy's just like living in Lexington.
Yeah.
And we're like, we need to take him out. Or someone in his family needs to be taken out.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
So, members of the Mulligan family, and the story has discrepancies. It's revealed in the newspapers, and when I say the newspapers, I mean newspapers from Lexington to Paducah and all around Kentucky cover this story. Mm. So initial reports stated that Judge Mulligan, his wife, his son Dennis, and two of the daughters were at this meal on September 24th. It's a Saturday. It's either at 2 o'clock or at 4 o'clock, depending on which story you read, right?
4 o'clock seems like an odd time for a meal.
It does. It does. But who's to say?
Right.
So Dennis Mulligan, I should say, is the oldest son from the second marriage.
Okay.
The meal was presented by Louis Mitchell. He worked for the family. He had worked for the family for over a decade. I should also mention he was a black man. So reports go that Louis starts talking to Jenny, as they referred to her. This is Mrs. Mulligan, saying, "Don't eat anything unless I tell you to, or if I tell you it's okay, you can eat it." Well, she wasn't really taking him seriously, it seems. So she's like, "Oh, should I eat the soup?" He's like, "Yes, you can eat the soup. Should I drink my coffee?" "Yes, you can drink your coffee." And then he presents this baked salmon. And she says, "Should I eat the salmon?" And he says, "No."
Oh.
But she doesn't pay attention.
Genevieve.
I know. So I guess as a trying to get someone else's attention, mm-hmm. he takes Dennis, her oldest son, to the side. And he says, "Don't eat the salmon. There's something the matter with it." So Dennis takes him a little bit more seriously and starts probing, asking more questions. "Well, what's wrong with the salmon? Why shouldn't we eat the salmon?" And finally, Mitchell confesses that it's poisoned. And Dennis doesn't really seem to believe him because this seems far-fetched. You know, he's been in the family for all of this time. Why are you serving us poisoned salmon? And then Mitchell says he knows it's poisoned because he poisoned it himself.
So not the cook.
Not the cook.
Okay.
Right. So at this point, the details of the story emerge that Judge Mulligan himself was not at this meal because they phone him and he phones the detectives. The detective's name was Walter Marshall. He arrives at Maxwell Place with a bunch of other detectives. They question Mitchell. And they were like, "Well, you poisoned the salmon yourself. You've admitted it. Why did you change your mind? And he said when he imagined Jenny taking a bite of the salmon, he felt so badly because she had stood up for him and been very kind to him over the years. He got into some legal trouble and was in jail, and she helped him out. And Dennis also, he said, had been very kind to him. So he couldn't go through with it.
But the two daughters, we don't need them.
I don't even know if they were there.
Yeah.
But so nonetheless, Mitchell gets taken to jail. The salmon gets sent to Professor A.M. Peter at what was then called State College, mm-hmm. now the University of Kentucky, to test the salmon to see if any of this story actually checked out. Well, they test the salmon. And I should also say it's very cool. We have glass plate negative photos of the salmon when it was sent for testing. It's one of the most fun parts about the job.
Wow, it sounds like CSI.
Yeah. I know. And I had seen that image of the salmon, and it had no context in the description. It was just, you know, salmon.
You're right. Baked salmon.
And then I was able to put it all together because Dr. Peter, many early scientists were photographers because of that relationship to chemistry. And so he served as a photographer, too. And so it was an amazing discovery for me when I found that photo and then was able to piece it to this. So Dr. Peter conducted the test and concluded that there was enough arsenic in the salmon to at least kill 50 people, and that one bite would have been lethal. It would have certainly taken out the entire family.
Do we know how he procured arsenic?
We do. I'm not going to tell you just yet, though.
Stay tuned.
On the edge of my seat.
I know. So this is when the newspaper coverage starts on September 25th. It's everywhere. You know, Mulligan's servant tries to poison family. One of the Paducah papers said that the family was near death, but physicians revived them. I mean, so it's like this story was growing out of proportion even to what had really happened.
Lexington's own yellow journalism.
It was so sensational. And even in the papers, they call it sensational. Mm-hmm. They refer to this case as being the only thing that people can talk about. Right. So things get a little, the story gets a little wonky throughout this time frame. So Mitchell is continually questioned about this incident. You know, why? Why did you poison the family? And he starts telling these stories. And who knows if this is just duress or if he's trying to come up with an explanation for his motives. But one of his stories, he talks about seeing this woman all dressed in black and outside in the garden, and maybe she did something. He talks about a masked man in the pantry who got away. And so people are really starting to lose, the newspaper published a story that there were two theories. Either he was going mad or someone paid him to poison the family. So with further questioning, finally Mitchell says there's a second person involved. And that this person is a near relative of the family. And so this is all sort of pre-trial work. And when right before the trial, Mitchell makes a confession, and he starts to tell the story. The story that he tells is that James Mulligan, this is a son from the first marriage, came to Lexington from Chicago on Friday before the dinner, and that, which was known, but James hasn't entered the story really at this point. Judge Mulligan had written a note to James and asked Mitchell to take it to him. He was down in Judge Mulligan's law office. So Mitchell does, and then he recounts a strange interaction that he has with James, where James seems paranoid, and he asks if Mitchell saw Judge Mulligan write this note himself, if Jenny was in the room with him when he wrote this note, if she made him write the note, and states he's going to get his revenge and gives Mitchell a blue envelope full of poison and tells him he will pay him $100 to poison Jenny. He asked him, according to this confession, to put it in her coffee or in food. So perhaps Jenny was the target.
Right.
So people are called to testify. Jenny's called to testify. Judge Mulligan is called to testify. James went back off to Chicago and wasn't present for the beginning. But Dennis testifies. Dr. Peter testifies. The cook testifies, apparently, as well, finally. And that's when things get even more salacious. They start revealing family secrets. They read family letters. They reveal that there is a significant rift between the two sets of children, that the first four felt abandoned by their father. There was an inheritance dispute with Judge Mulligan's parents, their grandparents. There was talk of James' moodiness, is what they called it. They told a story about how he disappeared for 3 weeks and was traveling in the South, and in the words from the newspaper, that he was disguised as a tramp, and they sent him money and he came back home. So there's lots, so this well-respected sort of society family
is now having their
their
secrets out.
All
in,
the secrets.
In the newspaper.
Yeah, there's a rift between one of the daughters and Judge Mulligan, and they don't talk anymore and didn't attend the marriage. All sorts of things. James does eventually testify, but nothing is really resolved. They let the cook go. The cook went back to work. We're the Mulligan family.
Yeah.
The trial goes on until about June of the next year.
Oh, wow.
No charges were ever filed against James, Jim Mulligan. And the jury couldn't reach consensus about Mitchell. And so they acquitted him as well. And the mystery of who poisoned the salmon was never fully solved.
Oh, wow. That is... There are so many angles of this.
So many. And what about the cook?
Like, wouldn't... I have a lot of... There's like a physics question here, right?
Right.
So if you're putting arsenic on something, it has a... You can see it. Like, it's not... Right? Like, you're...
You know, that's another one of those details when I was reading through all the newspaper articles where there are a couple of discrepancies. So both Mitchell and the cook agreed that she made the salmon the night before.
Okay.
And then in one story, it says that she stated that when she pulled it out of the refrigerator, it was normal, and that at some point there was white powder all over it. And then that it was like mixed in at some point. And then in one of the other stories, it says that the arsenic was baked into the salmon and that didn't impact its potency. So I don't know.
Huh.
I think you would notice.
You would notice some powder. Like,
yeah.
You don't put powdered sugar on salmon.
No.
I mean, maybe you do.
Right.
Not I don't think so.
I've had it with like brown sugar baked.
True.
Really, really good.
I don't know enough about arsenic to know if it melts like that. I'm guessing it doesn't, but
yeah. When you're historians and not chemists, you know, I don't really know the properties of arsenic.
We need the forensics experts right here in the studio.
So you find this picture going to sort of because we're historians and archivists. This is all in the newspaper, but it's definitely something that probably remember this with the Mulligan family, but it's not a really well-known piece of Lexington history. How do you get there?
So we had an addition to the Mulligan family papers come in.
Okay.
And one of our grad students was processing the collection, and she found a letter talking about it.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so, of course, she was... We love to share our finds with each other. And she was like, oh, my gosh, I found this letter. They lived right there, you know, because our King Library is next to Maxwell Place. So she's pointing. She was like, they tried to kill the whole family. And so, you know, we all got into it. And then I talked about the photo. And then, newspaper research is amazing.
So, it really is. Yeah. It's incredible. And it's just the family just deposited another box and a letter's in there. Was it a letter of a contemporary at that time?
At that time.
Oh, incredible. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I can't believe. We all know, like, this is how true crime is, right? Like,
right?
Most of the time, we don't have a real answer. Did you all... A little insider historian banter here. Do you have a theory?
That was going to be my question. Definitely.
I kind of think it was James. And there's a little nugget in one of the stories that explained why Mitchell might need more money during this time and why he might have agreed to it. Mm-hmm. He and his wife to join his brother, and they needed somewhere like $187. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that might have tipped him over the edge to be able to have that money in hand to be able to leave and go be with his brother. And some of the stories about James seemed kind of sketchy. Like, his stepmother had helped him significantly, and there, among the letters that were read in court, there were letters that were, he was so thankful to her for helping him financially and while he was in Chicago. And it did seem like he had very different sides to his personality, and that there could have been a very dark side.
Yes. And did they, just to back up to the beginning, the four children from the first marriage, they stayed at Maxwell Place through their, like, until they became adults with Genevieve?
They did. In her Genevieve's testimony, she talks about them living there like through their early 20s. I've seen reference, but I didn't read this myself, so I don't know that this is true. But in one recount of the story, it says that the first four children were sent off to boarding school. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I do believe that they did all live there. Till their 20s.
So there's a relationship with both Genevieve and the second family's children, but also the household staff.
Right.
Amazing. That is incredible.
I'm getting chills.
I know. And you can see the slide.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll make sure that that's linked in the description on the website for the podcast. But those aren't the only finds in a UK archive. You also have a book out that relates to Culinary Month, less salacious.
Much less.
But still very cool.
Much less.
Less dangerous eating.
Yes. Well, unless you're like getting mutton from the side of the road or something.
Yeah, there's none of that in there.
The Historic Kentucky Kitchen. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the Historic Kentucky Kitchen is a usable cookbook, but it's also an amazing piece of history and tradition. It has recipes from 1850 through 1950, about 100 of them. They're primarily all handwritten recipes from Kentucky families, and the recipes were all tested, standardized, given instructions in many cases. To include in a cookbook, you know, that covers anything from egg dishes and vegetables and soups, meats and desserts.
Do you have a favorite?
I have so many favorites. But, and this isn't because we're talking about Maxwell Place, but one of my favorite recipes is from Frances Jewel McVeigh, who was Frank McVeigh's wife, again, the first UK president and wife to live in Maxwell Place, and she was known for her hospitality and her parties and her food. She was also Dean of Women. She was a very talented woman. But this particular recipe is a mushroom soup recipe, and it's so good. I've probably made it the most as far as savory dishes go, because so many of the desserts are really good, and there's two of those that I make a lot. I know you asked for my favorite, and now I'm giving you like three.
I want all of them.
But there's a really amazing orange pie.
Oranges in Kentucky.
It was around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. Oranges were, yeah. I don't know if I would go as far as to say a common gift, but they were a regular gift when they were shipped in from the South. Mm-hmm. And lots of adults and children would get oranges in their stockings. Mm-hmm. And I had never had an orange pie until I tested this one for the cookbook. Delicious. And then there's a butter cake. And I mean, you know, how can you go wrong with that?
Absolutely. Oranges. I have an orange story real quick related to intersections, the new exhibit. So, yes, of course, we oranges shipped in and as a gift. That's a very, we know that that was sort of a traditional stocking stuffer. But James Ben Ali Hagen had a greenhouse, like a citrus greenhouse at Elmendorf that included oranges and grapefruits, which is like wild to think about in like 1905 on the north side of town, recording oranges in this massive greenhouse. So,
fun.
You know, not as unique as maybe we would think.
Yeah.
Which is wild. And partnered with UK and dairy and all those sorts of things. It's, you know.
I'll have to go back and look and see if we have any photos of that.
You do. Because I have one in the exhibit of the greenhouse, and it shows the oranges. Yay. They're really incredible. Any other fun culinary finds or things you want to highlight from the archives?
Oh, gosh. Well, I just got this really exciting collection.
Yes.
2 days ago, maybe?
Breaking news.
It is, I would say there's a couple hundred menus from mostly Lexington restaurants, but some outside of Lexington, all from, I'm guessing, the 80s through the 90s. And so a lot of these restaurants aren't here anymore. Mm-hmm. Some of them, most of them are local restaurants, but there are some chains, people who, you know, want Chi-Chi's to come back would be really excited to find the Chi-Chi's menu.
Yes.
But, you know, there's Coach House menus.
Of course,
yeah. There's an earlier Dudley's menu, which is really cool.
And Amato's in there?
I think so.
Yes.
New Orleans House, perhaps?
Ooh.
Oh, I know that there was one, because I thought maybe that one wasn't in Kentucky, and it was.
Yeah.
There's this awesome airport, Bluegrass Airport menu. The cheeseburger is like a dollar. Yeah.
If only.
I know.
Can you imagine?
The prices are just...
Add a couple zeros after that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So I have just been pouring through those. That's... They're still sitting on my table.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to let go of them yet.
I'm like paging through them for lunch ideas.
I know.
Saratoga chips.
Yes.
Appropriate, too, that we're talking about that during Culinary Month. And you got Restaurant Week coming up later on in the month.
Yeah, there is. You know, we get, and I'm sure you all get this, too, from researchers, so many of those sort of nostalgic questions of where was the Saratoga? Or I don't remember. When did Alfalfa's move off campus to downtown or those sorts of things? And then it leads to these incredible conversations about people's experiences. And so menus are, I have a very soft spot, and I'm jealous that you have, I love that you have the collection and now we'll all get to enjoy them. But I'll be borrowing some.
It's okay. I know. Yeah.
But those will become, that'll be a big, you know, if they're digitized, I bet you get a lot of traffic and people looking at those. And that's awesome. Well, thank you for being here and for not only getting us excited about a little bit of true crime and early 20th century Lexington, but the books as you're cooking for your 4th of July cookout or your summer cookout. Don't forget historic Kentucky Kitchen and a good Kentucky-based recipe straight from the UK archives.
How do people get that book, by the way?
Well, you can get it anywhere you buy books. You can order it, of course, straight from the University of Kentucky Press, who published it. It's on Amazon. They have it at Joseph Beth. It's all over the place.
Very cool. Very cool. Awesome. And Mandy, as we wrap things up, we just want to encourage people to go see that 250 Lex exhibit, Intersections. At the museum.
Yes, please come see us. And I forgot to mention, you can give us some feedback. So after you've viewed the exhibit, please let us know how you are going to make Lex history in the next 25 years. And if there's someone that you think we should think about for a future exhibit, please let us know who that person might be and why they should have an exhibit. They should be part of an exhibit.
Super. And the veterans banner.
Yes. So you may remember last year on Vine Street, the city, the LFUCG Commission on Veterans Affairs and the museum put up banners honoring Lexington's veterans. The first year was the Veterans Hall of Fame inductees from Fayette County. This year, you can nominate an important veteran to you in your life to be part of the banner display that'll be up in November along Vine Street. You can get all the details on our website at lexhistory.org. Those nominations are due August 1st.
All right, so there's a little bit of time to get that those nominations in. That is all the time that we have for today on Lex Talk History. We will see you again very, very soon.
You've been listening to Lex Talk History, a monthly podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts or download Lex Talk History from the podcast page at WUKY.org. And if you haven't done so already, please make plans to visit the Lexington History Museum soon. Get started on your tour at lexhistory.org.